limits of human knowledge. It's a very precise field. And in this precise field, it has a particular language code. And this language code can be difficult to learn, and it is extremely precise. Now, the reason I'm saying this is when you approach the mind in this way, which is what we're talking about really, you know, mental stuff, you can approach it through a psychological approach, which is mostly what we do, because there's a shared basis here, including a shared language code. And when we approach it from a psychological point of view, it's good because we can start dealing with it straight away. Yes? It's how we behave. The other way of approaching it, which is the epistemology way, very, very, it's, we can say difficult, but not really. It is just precise with its language code. And what happens after a while is these two really need to meet up. These two need to meet up. And what comes from that meeting is really a clarity of the nature of reality, a clarity from both the psychological and the epistemology route. When you're dealing with things like permanence and impermanence, when you're dealing with conceptual minds, because that comes into it, and perception, the difference between conception and perception, all of that comes in and has to be brought into play whenever you're discussing to any depth mind and permanence and impermanence. Okay? So it is a branch of study that it's worth doing. Even to a certain level, it's worth doing, because then you get a kind of clarity. If you haven't got that, then we start using words which mean different things to different people. And so what we're going to do now is just see if we can get some sort of criteria here that we can hang on to and say, right, this is the criteria to which I'm going to measure everything against to see if this is permanent or impermanent. Okay? And you know, not always answers will be given. Sometimes when naughty things, it's worth keeping as a question. I don't know if you've noticed, but questions are always much more interesting than answers. Have you noticed? Mm. And actually, being able to ask a good question is far more intelligent than the answer you give. Do you not think? So, keeping a question is useful. So, if we refer back to the definition of impermanence, that which is momentary, right? So, we're talking about momentary in time, and in momentary in a kind of physical continuum. So momentary in time, as I've said, is you're looking at, if something is impermanent, you're looking at something that does not exist in the same way from moment to moment. Deeper than that, from the very birth of that moment, nothing stays the same. It's always changing. So if something is always changing, deteriorating, coming into being, flowing, and there's no space for stasis, no space for permanence, moment to moment, the birth of the moment that by its nature is impermanent, anything that has some form of permanence, whether it's momentary, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, half an hour, a year, 20 years, a millennium, anything that stays the same for any period of time, you could say is permanent. You could say that. If someone ever says to you, you know, clever clogs people say things like that, is this permanent or impermanent? If you're not sure, just say impermanent. That high chances are you're right, okay? High chances. Are you right? You have some permanent. Ooh. Unless they're being tricky, eh? Usually it's right. So what criteria are you using here? Well, you can say all functioning phenomena are impermanent. Because all functioning phenomena come together through causes and conditions. And anything that comes together through causes and conditions is by its nature impermanent. So that's a criteria you can measure against. As well as this momentary in time and momentary in the physical continuum. So all composite phenomena, all conditioned phenomena kind of mean the same thing, is impermanent. Well, that would mean then that if things are non-functioning, the chances are they're permanent, and that's true. Things that are not brought about by causes and condition, permanent, that would be true. You can also say, one criteria to use is, if you can perceive the phenomena through the physical senses, then it's impermanent. That's a good one. Mm-hmm. If the phenomena cannot be perceived through the physical senses, the chances are permanent. Is this making good criteria to use? Keep it in your mind and measure it against. So, if we say non-functioning phenomena impermanent, without going into any great depth, then there are examples you can bring up and really look at closely. For instance, emptiness. Emptiness is permanent. Does it match against the criteria? Can emptiness be viewed by the six senses? No. It can't. Does emptiness change? No. Not in any way. Can you point at emptiness? There you are. No. So that's helpful. So if you're asked to give an example of a permanent phenomena, you bring this criteria, these criteria into being. And so emptiness fits that. The other example people give as a permanent phenomena is what's called non-produced empty space. Now this shows you how delicate and how precise people can be. Not space. Not produce space, which from the phenomenological point of view, from epistemology, is full of impermanence. It's full of quantum things going on, coming into being, changing. So they're very clear, it's unproduced empty space. Is that a permanent phenomenon? Yes, it is. Can you point to it? No, you can't.
Did you say non-produced?
Non-produced.
Oh, non-produced.
Can you see it with your senses? No. You assume it's there because it's not blocked. You see through non-produced empty space, so you can quite happily assume it's not there. Do you see what I mean? There's nothing blocking it. It's important, that one. You can say genetic images. Genetic images are permanent. And we've all used genetic images. If I say to you mother, father, holiday, house, a picture comes to your mind. You know, just comes to your mind. It's not real. It's not true. But it's an image, isn't it? It's a thing. And it tends to be a thing that's unchanging. It's a genetic image. It's produced by the conceptual mind. This is the thing. This is how we tend to view the world, through our conceptual mind. We never really see, according to Buddhist psychology and philosophy, we don't tend to see things as they are. We see things through genetic images. And a lot of our work with the mind is to actually move away from conception towards perception, direct perception. So now we can ask ourselves the question, am I permanent or impermanent? Using that criteria, what answer would you come up with? Impermanent. What about the Buddha? Permanent or impermanent?
Which Buddha?
The image.
Buddha manifests now. Permanent or impermanent? You're thinking about the Buddha, permanent or impermanent? Mm-hmm. It's an impermanent phenomenon. Mm-hmm. Emptiness isn't. Buddha is. Buddha nature, permanent or impermanent? It's a composite. Buddha nature is a composite, isn't it? It's made up of different things.
Yeah.
Can you point at it? That's helpful. Can't point at it. So that kind of leaning towards permanence. But it's a composite thing. Is it a functioning thing? Yeah. So that's kind of pointing the other way. We would all like, really, deep in our deepest heart, for the Buddha to be a permanent phenomenon. For Buddha nature to be a permanent phenomenon. Why? It is our habit, lifetime after lifetime, to try and grasp onto one thing that is unchanging. Really. Whether we call it Buddha nature, the Buddha, whether we call it God, whether we call it the soul, it's the habit we're in. There has to be something. Now, if you study this more and you look at the different schools of philosophy within Buddhism, then you'll come across school that say, well, you know, that doesn't exist, but this exists permanently, you know. So there are discussions, arguments, depending on which school. The school here, the school of thought here is called Prasangika Majjhimika, view of emptiness. And things do exist. They just don't exist the way we think they exist. So we're not saying nothing exists, just not the way we think. So that's something to think about. Okay? There are books on this. You can get teachings on it, but it tends to be... I've not seen it around that much. But if you can grasp onto what I'm saying here, then it will give you a good idea. Our mind is always wanting to find the flaw of things, right? Yeah, but maybe there's an exception to the rule, right? To own your own death, just realise, without any question, this is impermanent. Totally. And everyone else is in the same condition. And you either see that as a source of joy or a source of fear. Questions? I'm not expecting you to pick up on all this if you've not heard it before. No, just get the idea that the answers are there. It's a particular branch that needs studying. At the moment, though, because we're more to do with behavioural stuff, then the psychological approach is very helpful. But there comes a time when we have to bring in this epistemology. It's very important to bring that in. And then you learn the language code, you learn definitions, exactly what things are, so there's no mistake. But are there permanent phenomena? Absolutely. But it's nothing you can point at. If you can see it through your physical senses? No. What about time, by the way? There's a good one. Time. Using that criteria, what do you reckon?
Time is sequence, is impermanent, isn't it?
I would say so.
Time is a line.
Is it?
Time is a sequence.
Is it? It's what we think. Yeah, it's interesting.
I think if it is impermanent.
It is impermanent.
Yes,
that's right.
As I said, but I'm not sure if there's another kind of time, a kind of...
I would just think with ordinary time.
I don't know.
Okay. No, I didn't. We'll stick with one time.
The series of time.
But you could, I've heard it argued, hasn't it? You know, people say, well, you know, time fits this criteria, but not that criteria. So, it is impermanent.
Yeah.
But it's not physical time. Although it feels it, it's not. And it's not mental either. It holds a stasis of its own, really, a situation of its own. It's classified as impermanent, certainly. But time is something that's identified by other composite factors. It's not identified by itself. His Holiness often talks about the fingers of a clock, you know, the second hand going round. You say 5 minutes have passed. There's no 5 minutes. Where is it? It's not there. But you're imputing that on other factors. On the factors that the hand has moved. So based on something that is not time, you impute time. So it gets a bit tricky, eh? So I wrote this down because I forget some of these ones, but what you're looking at is, it's called a non-associated composite phenomena. This is what I mean. When you learn the language code here, we're really talking about something. But you don't have to remember that. But it's interesting. Time is imputed on something that is not time. It's imputed on other composite factors. And because of that, sometimes people take it as a permanent phenomenon. But it's not. Anyway, it's enough about permanence and impermanence. So what do we say if somebody says this is permanent or impermanent? 9 times out of 10? Impermanent. And keep the examples in your mind of what is permanent. And if you can, remember some of the criteria. And remember, we want something. We would love it if our teachers turned around and said, everything is impermanent except this. So thank God. Thank goodness. There's something, right? Okay. So let's settle down for another meditation. Love my meditations. So, before we do this, let's just think of this. We'll be going into this a bit later on, but mind and body, same or different? What would you say? Pretty different, eh? So certainly from a Buddhist point of view, that there's no, you know, there's no discussion on this. They're just very clear. The mind is matter. Yes, comes from matter. And when it disintegrates, it goes to matter. Right? It's born from matter, it is matter, and it will disintegrate into matter. Right? The mind is not matter. And this becomes quite important. The mind is not matter. But the mind is impermanent. Right? Now, why is the mind impermanent? Because of the criteria I've given you before. And here's what we hold in our mind now, is that consider that one moment of mind gives rise to the next moment of mind, gives rise to the next moment of mind, gives rise to the next moment of mind. Right? So if one moment of mind gives rise to the next moment of mind, it's a functioning thing. Right? It has causes and conditions. What is the cause of this moment of mind? The previous moment of mind. Yes? What is the cause of the next moment of mind? The present moment of mind. So what you're looking at with mind is one moment giving rise to the next moment. It's not relying on matter. This is important. It's not relying on matter. It's relying only on the previous moment of mind to exist. And it exists in a continuum, like the flow of a river. And that's, you know, we need to grasp that. So it's not matter. Why is this important with death? Because the body dies. But Buddhism is very clear, the mind does not. Does it change? Of course it changes, it's impermanent. It'll change, but it doesn't die. When the body dies, the mind does not. It changes. And it's so important that we grasp that, that mind is not the same as body. Now, you can say, oh, well, I know that. But many people do not. Physicists are beginning to produce paper now where they are talking about mind. Before, very rarely the physicist would talk about mind at all. Only brain. And if they talked about mind at all, they would say something like, mind is that which is produced by the brain. Or as Stephen Hawking once said, mind is what's vomited up by the brain. And it's only now that there are beginning to study the mind and its association with the brain as opposed to being caused by it. But there's not many papers. They're beginning to look at it, but there's not many papers produced on that. And Alan Wallace, I don't know if you know Alan Wallace, but he's a physicist, scientist, and a great teacher. He does a lot of work with different sciences and physicists. And I remember him saying to me, you know, if they did start to work on the mind, they wouldn't have a job. It's seen as being in many scientific establishments, it's seen as being superstitious. If you can't measure it, observe it, and repeat what you've done, then it doesn't exist. It doesn't exist. And so they're happy to study the brain, but not the mind. And they think they can get the mind through studying the brain. But the brain is matter. Is there a connection? Absolutely there's a connection. Yeah, they function together. Try separating brain and mind and see how long you last. Not long. So there's a functioning thing, but they're not the same. And that's really, really important. Functioning. If you take reincarnation into consideration, for instance, we think of the mind as being this thing here. I mean, we know it's not, but kind of we think it is. That can reincarnate into an ant. The mind that transfers. And it's configured by the brain of the ant. So it affects, each will affect. If you reincarnate into the body of a deer, the brain of a deer will configure, limit, predispose that mind. So that the effect is there, but it is not the same thing. Questions?
Yeah, are we talking about consciousness now? Or?
Yes, you can say at the moment we're talking, consciousness is the same. Just synonymous,
So is mind an energy?
You could say.
And does that flow? Does that flow never stops?
Never. You see, why? Why? Is it something to believe in? Well, I don't know. But if one moment of mind gives rise to the next moment of mind, right? Mm. What gave rise to this moment of mind?
Previous.
Okay. What gave rise to that?
The same.
And what gave rise to that?
Period.
And what gave rise to that? So where is the beginning? Can the beginning be something that is not mind? No. So if you move forward then, if this moment of mind gives rise to that moment of mind, what does that mind do? What does that give rise to? What does that give rise to? What does that give rise to? When does it stop? How can it stop? Does it fizzle out? And so we have to be confronted with beginningless and endless. And it's not something we're used to. We're used to thinking everything has a beginning, a middle, and an end. That's how life is, isn't it? We know that. Really? Use your intelligence and look around you. Where is the beginning of anything? I mean, you'll be here all day, all week, all year, trying to find a beginning of something. But that's how we think. Everything's got a beginning and a middle and an end. And it just isn't true. Certainly not the case with the mind. So now you've got the concept of beginningless mind. And if you have the concept of beginningless mind, you very close has got to become endless. Where does it end then? And if it's not the same as the body, what happens to the mind when the body dies? Because if you're grasping on to the mind being one moment giving rise to the next, this kind of continuum, which works with the brain but is not the brain, what happens when the body dies? You have to start addressing that, eh? Logically, address it logically. What happens? And you have to throw some stuff out. And some of the stuff you have to throw out is beginning, middle, and end. Especially when it comes to mind. Again, if you get the chance to get some teachings on mind, very useful. Anything else? If you're uncertain at the moment or slightly confused, this is wonderful. Okay? It's much better than being certain about nonsense. Be uncertain, be confused, and be happy with it. Because a confused and uncertain mind, if it's healthy, is an inquiring mind. Much better to be that than being really definitely sure that things have a beginning, middle, and end. Much better. Embrace your confusion. It's great.
So is it like a set, a unit of energy? So
is it?
So
does it sound like a set unit of energy?
I suppose what I'm comparing it is to what sort of physical matter would be. So if you'd say you have a pebble in front of you, and say that was just, so you just isolated that pebble, it would be constantly changing. It would be changing energy forms. I suppose physics would say it's the same amount of energy which is constantly there, but the energy is changing into heat, it's moving, etc. And that will continue, you know, forever.
Does that help?
So just
with mind?
Is that the same with the mind, where it's a...
I think you could take components of that, but I think there's a danger. And when I say there's a danger, I'm always talking about myself. For me, there'd be a danger. Why? Because I don't like comparing mind with energy, with matter of any sort, because it's just not the same component. Can it behave in similar ways? I'm sure it can, especially if you've got some understanding of physics. But for me, that would be not for somebody who understands physics. I don't think that would be a problem. For me, it would be a problem. So, mind to me stands unique, and that is helpful to me. But if you can find some comparisons that help you, then no problem. But really, it's not matter. Mm. It may behave like matter in some ways, but it isn't. Matter comes from matter. Matter does not give rise to anything like mind.
Yeah, I get that. I suppose it's just comparing the way the energy sort of moves.
If your understanding is good enough and that helps, then fine. My understanding of physics is very poor. Therefore, it would not help me that way. It would only confuse me. And I'm very wedded to things that work. I like things working. Okay, so let's settle down. And if you can, use the two-breath method or any other method you know to relax the body quickly. Just relax it. It's very important and useful to catch a taste of this continuity of mind. Without a functioning understanding of this, or a taste that this could be true, then the death meditations we'll be doing will have no basis. Reincarnation, the bardo, will have no use for you. There's no use for this. What's the problem? And so death, within the Buddhist way of thinking about it, reincarnation, bardo, does rest upon having a good taste of the continuity of mind. If you don't have that, then it makes a nonsense of everything else to come. So we draw the mind inward. And become aware of our thoughts. Now, as soon as you say that to anyone, the thoughts just go, the mind just goes blank, right? But just relax with this. Just relax. Thoughts, ideas, emotions surfacing. Your physical senses impinging on the mind. Thinking about what you're hearing, saying, thinking, touching. What's for lunch? Will I manage not to eat supper? Whatever's going on, try to get a feeling of all these thoughts, ideas, emotions flowing through the mind. Your stance at this thing is like a detached observer. So it's like the mind observing the mind, and that's possible. Now skim your consciousness from your thoughts, ideas, emotions as you woke up this morning until now. Just touch lightly on the different feelings and thoughts and ideas from the moment you woke up until this present moment. Really go through it. You get up, you get washed, you get dressed. Should I have breakfast? Should I not have breakfast? Try to identify all these different thoughts, ideas that you had all the way through today until now. It can be like tracing a river, the river of thoughts. Now ask yourself the question, the stream of thoughts you had when you first woke up, until the present moment, is it the same stream of thoughts that you're experiencing now? Not the same thoughts, but the same stream of thoughts. That's the question. Ask yourself, is this the same stream of thoughts that I'm experiencing now than I had when I woke up until now? Keep asking yourself the question, and if you have an answer, ask yourself again, yes, but is that right? Yesterday evening, into the night, that stream of consciousness that led you into sleep or dreams, is that the same stream of consciousness that you're experiencing now? Investigate. Trace the stream of consciousness to yesterday, asking yourself the same question. The stream of consciousness yesterday, is it the same stream I'm experiencing now? Now continue to journey back 2 days ago, 3 days ago, asking yourself the same question. Last month, what was I doing? What was I thinking? isn't the same stream as now. Last year, trace this continuity back, as far back as you can. Young adulthood, adolescence, school days, as a child, infancy. Some people can even remember birth. Trace it back as far as you can, asking yourself the same question. Just relax, open your mind, allow the memories to flood in. Nothing to worry about, just experiencing the continuity. From your earliest memories until the birth, same stream of consciousness. What about when you were in the womb? Did it suddenly start in the womb? How could that be possible? Stream of consciousness back to the conception. Maybe that's when it started. Really? And follow, if you can, that stream of consciousness, just the idea of it, further back even to that. Each moment arising from the previous moment. Back and back and back. And you start to consider this continuity of mind, this mind stream. Could it possibly be beginningless? Or do you think it started at a certain point? If so, how and when? Just question yourself. many people believe that the mind comes about somehow at conception or a certain time in the womb. Some people totally believe it comes from the father and the mother. But how can that be possible? Did it come into being from nowhere? Poof? You suddenly, a mind appears from nowhere? Is that possible? Does it come into being without causes and conditions? So gently become aware again of this present moment in time, the thoughts, ideas, and emotions. And if that's difficult, just be aware that you have them flowing through your mind. Now fast forward this through the rest of today. You will experience different emotions, different thoughts and ideas. Can you see that they're part of this continuum, not something separate? Fast forward to the end of the course, how you'll be feeling, what you'll be doing, what you'll be thinking. Can you feel the continuity of this stream of consciousness? For the rest of the year, and the years to come, the flow. And now you're at the moment of death. What happens next? The body will die, certainly. What happens to the mind? Question yourself. What's next? And consider the different possibilities. Do I cease to exist? Does the mind die when the body dies? Or does it continue to change and transform within the continuum, encountering new experiences? Question yourself. Keep the mind open, the possibility of continuum from moment to moment, life to life.
stay with it.
At the time of death, what are the different possibilities? And relax. So the idea here, as I said, is to try and get a feeling for, a taste of this type of continuity. Now, why is that important? Well, for many reasons, some obvious and some not so obvious. Habitually, throughout our many lifetimes, I'm assuming here many lifetimes, okay? We've been thinking and believing and not even questioning that the mind and the brain are more or less the same. When people say, oh, I've got these bad thoughts in my mind, you know. Look to where they put their hands. Lama Yeshe used to say that. Some people go, oh, I just can't think right, you know. We've got this idea. Some people go like this when they're thinking of mind. Notice that. But most of us, it's here. It's almost as if it's inbuilt that we believe the mind is here. Static, a thing, immovable, unchanging, synonymous with the brain. That's what we've got. Now, if we're saying look at it in a different way, then it's not easy. It's not even easy allowing your one part of the mind to look in other parts of the mind. Somebody says to you, look at your thoughts now, and you go, no thoughts. Where'd it go? The mind is full of thoughts. Let alone tracing a continuity back. For some people it's easier than others, that's true. But for many of us, you need to get this idea. Use logic to sustain, to give you a basis of this. Right? There's a lot of ignorance in the world. Okay, a lot of ignorance. And you've got innate ignorance and you've got learned ignorance. Innate ignorance is that type of ignorance you're born with. Okay? And this is part of that. But it's also part of learned, a communal understanding that mind and brain are the same. There's a kind of a communal ignorance. And we have to go a wee bit beyond that. And use logic to do it. Nobody's saying you've got to have a different sense of beliefs. No. Use your knowledge of physics. Use your scientific understanding. Use your logic. And see what happens. And this continuum. That's really important. This idea of continuum. It's not the same thoughts, obviously. But it is the continuum. It's the same continuum. And if you really grasp the idea that one moment of mind gives rise to the next moment of mind, gives rise to the next. It's a bit like having a row of candles and one flame ignites the next, which ignites the next, which ignites the next, yes? Same flame, you could say. There's a continuity. And because it's so fast, it's like a river, really like a river. But it's actually more than that. It's like if you watch a waterfall, if you didn't know, you would talk about a sheet of water. It looks like a sheet of water. You can see movement, but it's obviously one piece, isn't it? You look at a waterfall. But you start going closer and suddenly you think, oh, wait a minute, there's gaps in this waterfall, right? But if you got the right magnifier and really looked, you'd see what? You'd see lots of different droplets and huge spaces in between the droplets. And this is how we want to use our mind. We need to use our mind like an the highest precision investigating tool. Highest precision. Take nothing for granted. Believe none of the ignorant stuff. It doesn't mean to say believe another set of beliefs. No, come to a conclusion though. Use your logic, use your understanding. And if that takes hold, then where is the beginning of that mind? Where is it? There's a little puffball somewhere hanging about going, wish I could get born soon.
Yes.
What does beginningless actually mean? And what does endless actually mean? And what has that got to do with the time of death? Because all of this gives rise to things like the bardo, Buddhist understanding, and many lifetimes. Not just many, beginningless. That's why this type of meditation is important. Not to take on a new set of beliefs, no. Trace with your own logic what's going on. And your mind, even if your mind is foggy at the moment, it will come brighter and brighter. You'll be able to trace stuff back. And you'll be able to remember to ask yourself the questions and not just hope that the meditation will end soon. How long is she going to go on for? Like that. Okay. So in groups of three, I'd like you to discuss how that went, what the problems were that you had. Anything came up in that meditation that's worth discussing with the group, do so. Okay? I'll check you after 10 minutes. But remember what I'm saying about how important this is, about the taste of it. And this is all to do with death. Can you imagine if you don't understand this? What about teachings on death? What's that going to mean to you? Nothing. Type of things came up in your discussion. How did you find the meditation itself? Is it one you're used to doing, or?
It's better for me.
Yeah? Felt reasonable?
It's changed.
Good. Feels more reasonable?
Yeah.
Anything? Anyone else?
Helpful. What I mean, that some of the things to ask, you know, like you said,
to ask
at the point of death.
Yes.
Ask, what are the options that one? Yes. You know, and it really made me think.
It's true. It does make you think, and that's really cool to be able to do that instead of just old knowledge, old understanding, really old ignorances, you know, what really happens? What else came up? Now, I know you were talking because I heard you. So I know other things came up. And remember, it also helps other people here to share a little bit. It's very useful.
Well, we started off by talking, just discussing how far we could actually remember back.
Yes.
And then discussing possibly why there was that point and how it felt and what instigated it. And then we went on to discuss about certain abilities to be able to remember being born and conception and previous lives even.
Mm-hmm.
And what, in fact, was the value of being able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And if it would not dilute one's concentration on the present moment.
But if you can go far enough back, I mean, I've met people who can't remember the birth, and I mean, they're not lying, they just can't. Some people just can't.
Mm-hmm.
For other people, it's like being in the hospital and being taken home by their parents. Mm-hmm. And I'm going, oh my Lord, I think my first memory was like I was about three.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
So what you have to do is you take the earliest memory and realize, actually, the more you do this meditation, the further back you go. I mean, just... But you then have to infer, did your mind start when you first remembered? Well, no, obviously you had a mind before. I mean, really. Were you totally mindless? I mean, I asked myself, was I totally mindless up to three? Well, my parents may say yes, but generally speaking, no. Right? So just the fact you can't remember in no way inhibits the fact that this has gone before. People say, well, I don't believe in previous lives because I don't remember them. I said, well, I don't remember what I did last Tuesday, but I know I was alive last Tuesday. You know, I'm sorry, it's not an argument. Do you know what I mean? If you're going to argue, give a good argument. Don't give that. It's nonsense. You know? So people can go quite far back. But even if you can only go back to a certain stage, you can then infer, can't you, that you did have a mind. People have talked about what you were like as a child, what you were like as a baby, what you liked, what you disliked. I mean, that's all your continuity of mind coming in here. So don't allow that to halt you. Just keep going back. Yeah. Anything else?
Receptivity to maybe what I... like dissolving a little bit, letting go a little bit. Maybe I had some idea about what I thought emptiness was or impermanence was or permanence was, and now it's, I think, more receptive,
more thinking about it, more seeing what else could be. Clarification.
Yeah, clarification. Just thinking, well, I don't know, like being okay with I don't know, and that's
at the
okay.
moment.
Yeah, just,
but I'm definite, I don't know, so it's okay. It's like, I really don't know. And that's really good. I mean, I'm quite happy with that type of thing. As long as that then leads to something positive, you know, so, well, what is it? How can I find this out? Yes. Anybody else going far back, how that went?
I suppose when you ask the question... you know, where did your mind start? Whether did it start at that moment?
Yes.
When you were in the womb before? So I suppose for me, what I was trying to think of then, what is the mind and what makes, what are the components of it and what is it different from, say, a computer which you turn on, which, you know, cognitive function, and then trying to look at the different elements such as, you know, self-awareness, which, you know, a computer wouldn't have, perhaps.
Okay, so this is a good point, Gareth, because what we really need to be clear about what mind is.
Mm.
So it's synonymous at this moment with consciousness, but if you're studying the mind, you need to be careful because there's five sense consciousness as well as mental consciousness. So, but at the moment, we're just saying consciousness.
Mm.
So let's look at a good definition of mind. And there's quite a few, but let's look at this one. It's quite easy, Sangha. Mind is clarity and knowing. That's all. So the nature of mind is clarity. Clarity. Its function is to know. Anything else is the mind working. But what is the nitty-gritty? What is this definition? clarity and knowing. Everything else is adventitious to it. Knowledge, this type of thing. And knowing, you can use a word like awareness as well. But if you think of a science, Asanga is always good because he talks about always nature and function, which I think is very useful. So the nature of the mind is clarity. When you think what clarity is, I mean, most of us have never experienced clarity, but we have an idea. It's kind of not cluttered by anything. There's no, in clarity, there's no barrier. There literally is no barrier. You and what you're observing are one. It's just clear. Just pure clarity. Its function is simply to be aware, to know. Remember, I'm not saying to know what. I'm saying to know. So, with that definition, it's worth working with that. See how that goes. Because mostly, through this life, it's hard to see that our mind is cluttered with thoughts, ideas and emotions. And we tend to say that is the mind. And on some level, you can say that's true. You can say that's true. But in its purest sense, mind is clarity and knowing. It's worth sitting with that for a while. I mean, it's good to get definitions in your mind. There'll be several definitions, okay? They don't contradict each other. It's just some are put in some ways that appeal to you. It seems reasonable. Personally, I like brevity in explanations. As long as it's short, I'm quite happy. When it gets over one sentence, I'm not so happy. So clarity and knowing, that's mind. His Holiness is very clear. It's a definition he gives all the time. And he also says it's the most difficult topic to understand, mind. Much more difficult than emptiness. Emptiness can be perceived through logic alone. Not the experience of it. Remember, but the understanding of it can be done through logic. Mind, more difficult. One of the most difficult topics, His Holiness says, there is. Because what's investigating the mind is the mind itself, the mind investigating the mind. You need some control for that.
So when we're looking back, what are actually, you know, we're looking back at memories of ourselves, our sort of personalities.
Yeah, memories are contained within this flow, isn't it? This flow of mind.
Yeah, that's right, but that's not what you're speaking about.
Yes, that's okay. It's within, at the moment, this particular meditation is not about looking at clarity of mind. It's not about looking at its function. No, that's... I mean, obviously, if you know it, then it's in there. That's quite useful. But the purpose of this meditation is really to get a taste of that continuity. That one moment of mind giving rise to the next. Because in relation to death, this is what you need to understand. You need to understand this. Anything else come up?
Sorry, is that like... You know how when you were saying this moment now in the mind, sorry, I hope I get this right. If I don't, please correct me. But this moment now brings the next moment, and this moment now was brought by the moment before.
Yes.
Does that mean that if the mind is... When we have a thought of a memory from 20 years ago,
yes.
is that the mind telling me that who I am right now and where my mind is right now is because of that event that happened 20 years ago? Is that why my mind is showing me that event?
I don't think there's a rationale like that behind it.
Okay.
I mean, there could be. Right? I wouldn't have thought so.
Okay.
We sometimes overthink that particular aspect, although it's always useful though, but it's just that flow. A reason why, a rationale behind that particular memory or thought, who knows? We could both have memories of what we think is the same thing, but what caused them, that memory to arise, and the result of that would be quite different. So that continuity, that moment-to-moment existence, but so fast... You don't, you know, it's just so fast. So fast.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Can you see how each point of this is worth its own field of study?
Yeah.
I mean, it really is. Okay, so as an overview, I'd like you to think of it in this way with the Buddhist concept of life and death. So the Buddhist idea of the body is that there is a gross body and a subtle body. Okay, that's their idea. That there's a gross body that you can see, feel, think, taste, touch, all the rest of it. But there's also a subtle body. And this subtle body contains energies and channels which are invisible but existent within this body. This is the Buddhist idea. Okay. Now, with this comes along the idea of mind. So if there's two types of body, gross and subtle, then they often talk about two types of mind. Actually, in Tantra, or sometimes they'll talk about three types of mind. But if you look at two types of mind, you would also say then that there's a gross mind, this everyday mind, but there's also a more subtle mind. Now, that doesn't say that you've got two minds. No. No. But there's a potential within the gross mind is only the subtle mind plus, right? Plus all your ideas, emotion. Below this, even earlier, is a very subtle mind, which is plus nothing, which is the bare mind, the mere mind. And that's the mind that goes from life to life. So as our body, when we're dying, as our body breaks down, matter to matter, the mind, because it's got the ability to have different levels, gross, subtle, very subtle, it starts to shed preconceptions, concepts, ideas, emotions, and it becomes more subtle and more subtle and more subtle. And when the mind finally leaves the body, and when the Buddhist definition of death is very clear, it's when the mind and the body separate. In the West, you can have symposiums on this and when nobody really comes to any conclusion. The Buddhists are quite clear. When the mind separates from the body, that is death. The mind that separates, the mind that goes on from life to life, is a very subtle mind. So we're not saying there's three minds, we're saying there's three levels of mind. So it's this most subtle mind that leaves at death. So if that's the case, where does that, this is just an overview, where does that mind go? And so the sphere of existence, because remember we said one moment of mind gives rise to the next, so it has to have a pathway forward and a pathway back. It has no choice. So when the mind separates from the body, it enters what's called the bardo state. And you've all heard of, I'm sure you've heard of the bardo, which is a very complicated teaching in itself. But it's a sphere of existence which can be, depending what you read, you know, quite terrifying, quite dark. But the mind is shed of all, a lot of its baggage. And so being very subtle, it has clairvoyance, it has a subtle body, the mind has a subtle body within the bardo. They say the mind can hang about, you know, once they're dead for a little while, it can see their relatives, it can read minds, it's that subtle, it can do that, it can pass through walls, at a wish it can go wherever it wants to go. So there is an existence of this subtle mind with a subtle body. Now, there's lots of teachings on the bardo. You could certainly read that up. But that's, if we're saying one moment of mind gives rise, now we're talking death separated, where does it go next? So the bardo. And they say how long? 49 days maximum. That's what they say, maximum. And again, there's different teachings on this with slight differences. But mostly they say in the bardo about 49 days, but it can be, they tend to teach in series of sevens. And in the bardo state, what's driving the bardo being is grasping, generally speaking. Grasping for a new body, wanting a new body, searching for a new body. And if the bardo being doesn't find a body within 7 days, it has a mini death. and a mini rebirth, and it spends the next 7 days searching, searching, searching. And that can go on for as long as 49 days. This is what the Bardo teachings there. But I think what to remember is it's a realm. The mind is going on. Where does it go on to when it's separated from the body, the Bardo? Now, the Bardo state can be a matter of minutes. It could be a matter of hours. It could be a matter of days. It really does depend on karma and really on control. But what tends to drive a Bardo being is grasping after a new body. Grasping controls everything in our life without even knowing it. When you're dying, you're grasping to keep life. But there comes a point when you're grasping to let go of life as well. It's also a kind of grasping to let go. And then in the Bardo, it's grasping again. And they say it can be driven by fear, darkness, noise. I mean, if you read the Bardo with all, you'll see that there's quite heavy descriptions of the Bardo. And then after a state of time, they say that the Bardo being, and before it's born, the Bardo being, again, it's slightly different, depends what you read, but tends to have the body. If you look down at your body, if you're a Bardo being, you tend to have the type of body you're going to have your next rebirth. So if you're going to be male or female, you tend to have that type of body. If you're going to be an animal, you tend to have an animal's body. Although I have read other teachings where that's not mentioned. We rely on a lot of this. We rely on a lot of this from what the Buddha taught and what tantric practitioners teach and those with recall. And then they say the Bardo being sees its parents making love, right? And enters the crown of the head of the male, travels down through the central channel, and then out with the sperm into the mother. And once it goes into the mother's womb, and the sperm and the egg unite, the development is exactly the same as it is in the sciences. That's what they say. I've read so many different... there are many similarities, but there's also differences in this explanation. So that's a Bardo being. What drives all this? What is driving all this? What energy is driving is karma. Karma is driving all of that. Your propensities, your habits, the positive and negative karma, that's driving that. How you died, the state of mind you had when you died, that's also very important. That will certainly impact very deeply on your next rebirth. So peaceful mind is very, very important. So, all of these, you could spend years, weeks, months on this. But two types of body, gross and subtle. Two to three different levels of mind. Gross, hello. Subtle, the mind of dreaming is a subtle mind. Mind of dreaming is an experience of subtle mind. You can do a lot in a dream with your mind that you can't do here. It's not true. Those who remember their dreams. Yes. Yes. You can do a lot in your dreams. You can fly. You can walk through walls. You can do anything you like. It's great fun. But even that can become more and more subtle through the death process. So it is a very subtle mind that goes from life to life. Where does it go? Because it has to go. This energy is not suddenly going, oh, right, I've had enough. No, it goes on. It goes to the Bardo state. What does it do in the Bardo state? Mostly driven by grasping, mostly trying to find a new body. What's the energy towards that? Usually karma. 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 And texts are there to study about controlling your time in the Bardo state. I think you'd have to be quite advanced to do it, but there are people saying that they can do it. And so this... Because control is quite important, people start to practice in Tantra dying every day. Within the sadhanas they do, tantric practitioners, they will practice dying. Sometimes quite superficially, sometimes quite in depth. they go through the processes. But like I say, you can do it quite quick or you can do it long. They practice it. Why? Well, they want to recognise they're there to start with and not be frightened. Because fear is going to drive you to do things you really don't want to do. You want some control. And it's possible, they say. It's possible. So tantric practitioners do a lot of practicing on death when they're awake, but they also do dream yoga. They learn to control their dreams. And so, whereas most people, many people can't remember their dreams to start with. They are dreaming. I mean, you can wire people up and you can see they're dreaming, but they don't remember it when they wake up. Right? And you get people who remember their dreams. Some people can remember up to 6 or 7 dreams in one night. Very easily, you can do that. Train yourself to do that. And some people can lucid dream. So they can wake up within their dream. They're still dreaming, but they know they're asleep. They know they're dreaming. And so they can take over their body, their dream body, and do practices within the dream state. And this is by no means flights of fancy. This can be done. Right? Some people have a natural propensity towards that. Some people don't. But can it be learned? Yes, it can. If you want to, a couple of good books on that, I'm quite happy to, at the end of the course, to suggest. But it can be done. Now, interestingly about sleep and dreaming is the process of falling asleep mimics the stages of dying. It mimics it. And so, practitioners learn, or they try to learn, to fall asleep mindfully. And they notice when they're at this stage of sleep or they're at that stage of sleep. Why? Because there's physical sensations that occur and there are mental pictures come to mind. And so if you can recognise that you're falling asleep and you even recognise the first couple of stages of sleep, then the chances of you being able to control your dreams are much higher. If you can control your dreams, the chances of you controlling yourself within the bardo state are also quite high. Does that sound too esoteric?
No.
I don't think it is. No. I don't think it is. Many people I've met have had experience of lucid dreaming. I mean, it's been proved scientifically with Stephen LeBerge's work. It's very clear. Anecdotally throughout the years, people are able to do that. And if you can control that subtle mind in sleep, the chances of you controlling an even more subtle mind in the bardo is important. And if you can fall asleep mindfully, then you're awake as you fall asleep. Really. So you go from the sleeping state, from the wake state to the sleeping state mindfully. Now, practice that enough and you've got a chance of dying mindfully into the bardo. You have a chance. Any questions? I just want you to think about that during lunch. Really. It's only a broad overview, but unfortunately you haven't got the time to go into each one of these bits. But that's the stance, that's where we're coming from. That's the overview from a Buddhist point of view.
Does the length in the bardo state depend on your calm?
I would say so.
And is a long time better than a short time?
No idea. No idea. I have no clue about that. They start talking about the bardo and I get 10 minutes and I just... I have no idea. I have, you know, some people have explained that it can be so fast. It can be so fast, in and out, so fast. Or it can be longer.
Right. And just one other little thing on that topic. At what point do we lose this body and take on the subtle body that you say is either animal or male or female?
When the mind separates from the body,
all right,
then it takes subtle energies with it.
Mm.
So the mind and the energy becomes the mind and the body,
mm.
within the body.
And then you take on the new body.
Well, you go into the bardo, you may not notice it immediately. Mm. I don't know. Some books say you do. Mm. Some books say... But again, you see, who's going to say? But basically, if you see yourself in a body that's male or female or animal, whatever, that tends to be.
Mm.
But not every text says that. Some texts say that.
Because they do say in the Buddhist tradition, but also in other traditions, to leave the body until the mind has left.
We're going to talk about that later, but thank you. Thank you for reminding me, but not yet. But that in the overview, that's all I wanted before lunch, but thank you. I'll remember that. Thank you so much. Please enjoy your lunch. Enjoy, enjoy. And remember, it's silence until karma yoga. Thank you.